Dreaming of blissful summer days and creamy popsicles? Capture sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. Just one stick and 16 ounces of water can help hydrate you better than water alone. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Craig Simons, Emeritus Professor of History from the U.S. Naval Academy. His new book is Nimitz at War, Command Leadership from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. This is a book that can be used by current officers in the U.S. Navy and retired and future to understand the relationships between the men who were given a task without adequate resources to restart the United States Navy in the Pacific after the Pearl Harbor attack. Immediately, Ernest King, the Comanche, says, attack, attack, attack. He wants to get out there and punch. Nimitz doesn't have much of a fleet now. The battleships who had been regarded as the strength of all navies, the gun club, are either four of the number very badly damaged or sunk, including the Arizona. Four are badly damaged. So he has aircraft carriers. What is it that King wants him to do? And this is a good time to introduce Chester Nimitz's idea of calculated risk, Professor.
Yeah, calculated risk. That's an interesting concept. Nimitz came up with it when he was still a student at the U.S. Naval War College in the 1920s. And it's a relatively simple concept. It is that you don't take a risk that's greater than the likely benefit that will result from assuming that risk. And it's not something that you can calculate. The word calculation is a bit misleading. There are no numbers involved. There's no algorithm that can solve the problem for you. It's a matter of thought process, of nuance and assessment. But Nimitz is very good at this, and he sells this concept to his subordinate commanders as well and encourages them to think about the possible benefit to be derived from assuming a risk and measuring the value of those two things one against another.
April 42, following two raids by the carriers in various outposts of the Japanese Empire, not significant victories, but at least it was bloodying the nose of someone out there. Doolittle raid is launched quite in secret. The idea of bombing Tokyo with Army Air Force bombers taking off from the deck of the Hornet Enterprise accompanies. Nimitz regards this as a stunt. Why does he think it's necessary?
Well, he doesn't think it's necessary, but Nimitz was very good at choosing the battles he thought he could win. And by that, I don't mean fighting the Japanese. I mean fighting those who gave him orders, who worked for him or who worked alongside him. Pick the battles you're likely to win, and those you're not likely to win, you just have to make the best of it. And that's what the Doolittle raid was for him. Remember, Nimitz has only four carrier task forces. And here's a proposal that's going to send two of them, 50% of his entire offensive capability, off to conduct what amounts to a public relations stunt of dropping a few bombs on a few Japanese cities and then sacrificing the airplanes themselves by flying them in over China, perhaps finding Chinese airfields, but perhaps not. And Nimitz is skeptical that this is, in fact, a valuable calculated risk, but he's not going to get in the way of a scheme that originated in the White House.
The two big set-piece battles are Coral Sea in May and Midway in June. However, Nimitz makes considerations that are profound for these two battles because he trusts a man named Leighton, and Leighton trusts a man named Rochefort. Who are those, Professor?
Well, Eddie Leighton was the intelligence officer on husband Kimmel's staff that Nimitz inherited from his predecessor, and he ordered Leighton to report to him every morning at 8 o'clock in his office in advance of the staff meeting at 9 o'clock so that Nimitz had all the latest intelligence. And as it turns out, Layton was very good friends with Lieutenant Commander Joseph Rochefort, who ran this crypt analysis group in the basement of the 14th Naval District headquarters, where they tried to winkle some pieces of useful information out of Japanese radio traffic. So Rochefort's team would try to decrypt as much of the Japanese radio traffic as they could. Rochefort would summarize it for Layton. Layton would bring it to Nimitz, and Nimitz could use that information or not, if he trusted it or not, to make decisions about the deployment of his forces. And in both the cases you cite, he did.
Yes, the Enterprise and the Hornet are tasked for Doolittle, so they're not available. What's available is the Lexington and the Yorktown, and there is the opinion that the Japanese are going to be sending an offensive force into the Coral Sea or somewhere through the Coral Sea. The assumption is they're looking to cut the communications link between Australia and the United States, which would have been a profound blow to the Allied forces. So Nimitz deploys, Fletcher commanding, the Yorktown and the Lexington, becoming the Battle of the Coral Sea. And I believe this is the first time, help me, that a battle is fought by ships that never see each other. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. This is an aviation confrontation. All of the combat takes place from carrier-launched airplanes attacking one another so that the ships never actually sight one another in the Coral Sea. And it is a bold decision by Nimitz to do this. He, with half his carrier force gone, he sends the other half into the Coral Sea, 5,000 miles away, to get in the way of a Japanese force that on paper looks like it's vastly superior. It's quite a risk, especially at a time when the overall Allied strategy is to concentrate on Germany first. So here's a quiet man that King wasn't sure was bold enough, taking an extraordinarily bold decision.
The Lexington is lost. The Yorktown is badly damaged. However, there's more news from Rochefort and Layton that the Japanese are planning an offensive against what they discern is Midway Island. That means Nimitz now has two carriers, the Hornet and the Enterprise, and he learns when the Enterprise returns that Admiral Halsey, commanding Enterprise, is so afflicted with a skin condition he can't serve. Nimitz makes another risky choice. He chooses a man named Spruance. Who is he?
Raymond Spruance was the commander of the cruiser destroyer screen for Halsey's carrier task force. Nimitz knew him. In fact, Nimitz had already decided prior to the news about Halsey's skin condition that he wanted to appoint Raymond Spruance as his own chief of staff, as Nimitz's chief of staff. So he knew him and trusted him so that when Halsey said, when Nimitz, first of all, asks Halsey, well, if you can't go, who should take your spot? And Halsey immediately said Spruance, and Nimitz immediately accepted that, even though there were other, more senior aviator admirals available. Spruance was the guy both Halsey and Nimitz wanted to take over that job.
Yes, yeah, Spruance is the quiet man. Nimitz looks perfectly chatty compared to Spruance. We go back We get back out there with three carriers, the Hornet, the Enterprise, and the immediately repaired Yorktown. It'll take 6 weeks, Admiral. You've got 36 hours. It's an amazing, dramatic moment. They get back out there, and the plan is to ambush the Japanese carrier fleet. Nimitz has to wait. Again and again, Professor, in your book, Nimitz is waiting for news. They can't. They radio silence to the fleet, so the anxiety is enormous. The success is also overwhelming. At this point, we're learning a great deal about how the admirals dealt with each other, and I want to mention there's one particular case here that comes up again and again. Mitcher commanding Hornet, after action, a great success, four Japanese carriers destroyed. What is it that Mitcher does that makes Nimitz give him a second choice? We have a little more than a minute.
Well, Mark Mitchell, Pete Mitchell, which was his nickname, is one of the early aviators. He was excellent pilot. And of course, getting early into the aviation community means he got promoted up to command the Hornet. But during the Battle of Midway, it's pretty clear that Mitchell thought to himself, I'm the aviator. I'm the pilot. I know what the Japanese are likely to be doing. And so I'm going to send my planes west instead of to the southwest. And when it turns out that that was not a good idea, the after-action report that he filed disguised that fact. Spruance knew it. He told Nimitz about it. And Nimitz quietly removed Mitchell from his projected command of a carrier task force and instead assigned him to command a PBY squadron on the north coast of Oahu. But he did not make an issue of it. He did not prosecute Mitchell. He did not publicly reveal this information, which remained pretty secret for most of 70 years.
You use the word escrow. The book is Nimitz at War, Command Leadership from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Craig Simons is the author. We're headed to Guadalcanal. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.